You're listening to the Builderpedia podcast, the only podcast that takes you on the whole property journey, from planning, design, building, selling, and everything in between. Along the way, we'll introduce you to our network of friends and colleagues who are experts in their field. Now, here are your hosts, Matt and Jeannie from Ballast Point.
Welcome back to another episode of Builderpedia. In today's episode, we will be discussing different contract types and how the current landscape is changing the industry and the options available to us. This leads to a need for shareholders, including the clients, the builders, and contractors, to find new ways to adapt and work together cooperatively. Joining us today, we have my co-host Matt as usual, as well as a very special guest. Today we have Daniel Beasley, who is the director and architect at Stuckel Architecture, who brings with him a wealth of knowledge and insight on this topic. Good morning, Matt and Daniel. How are you guys going?
Hi, Jeannie. I'm good. Thank you. Firstly, Daniel, thank you so much. You're our first guest in a while. We've struggled to get anyone interested, so I'm very appreciative that you've taken the plunge and joined us. Thank you.
No, thank you. And thank you, Jeannie, as well for running this conversation here. I think you guys are taking a plunge as well, putting me up as your first guest, and I feel honored, and I'm passionate about what I do and always interested to talk about it.
Would you like to give us a bit of a background on, you know, your start in architecture and the work you like to do, what your particular area of interest are?
Yeah, sure. First of all, well done on the pronunciation of Stuckel. It's a bit of a question mark for some people, and it's we've even put on our website and socials a pronunciation key to try and help people. But that was kind of part of the name there was meant to have a bit of sort of mystique around it, and it actually comes from my middle name, and it was part of a double-barreled middle name, Charles Stuckel, a Slovenian pioneer over in the States. My dad's side is American and set up a settlement over there in Oregon. And the practice has been around since 2011 in various formats. I came out of the large corporates, PTW Architects, a pretty incredible training ground for a recent grad, learning the fundamentals of documentation, quality control, gained some pretty incredible experience on site at the National Gallery down in Canberra, and in particular working on this sculptural piece there in the landscape by an American artist, James Terrell. So really great way to cut my teeth as a recent grad. And then I probably felt overambitious and launched out on my own back in 2011.
Did you feel at the time you were ready to do that? Or were you really taking a leap of faith?
No, it was an absolute leap of faith. In fact, I probably regret doing it too soon, to be honest. I think that it's a slow burn, the vocation of architecture, and you don't really need to prove yourself too soon. And it's about those networks and connections that I think are really invaluable. But nonetheless, when you throw yourself in the deep end like that, you certainly skill up very quickly. And I have now had some really great opportunities to test myself on many project types, and see many building types also, through construction, from those initial sketches on yellow trays through to the final sign-off, which is always a real, real buzz. And I think that's kind of what drives me and the people in my practice as well, is that act of creation. So here we are starting with just an idea. And we even talk about that. What is the idea? Where is the idea? Is it in someone's head? Is it in a sketch? Is it in a reference? And taking the client on that creative journey, almost sharing with them that experience of creating something for the first time that has never existed in a really original time, place, and space, it's a thrill. And I think I'm never going to get tired of that. And that's, I think, what is really our kind of credo as a practice.
Yeah, taking so the journey is your main kind of, I guess, product it's the experience of the journey that you're really selling to clients. Is that what defines your practice?
It is. Yeah. And I make a promise to them. I make a promise that we'll end up somewhere that none of us could have imagined at the beginning of the project.
Yeah. And what's the project? What's the one project that you're most proud of or happiest with, or what's that one project that you've completed that's a highlight, I guess?
There's probably two I can speak to. One is the most recent one. It's a residential alts and ads where it was a very ambitious brief and a very ambitious builder who was prepared to go to great lengths to deliver it. And in fact, he ended up winning the Young Builder of the Year National Award in the MBA, which is, I think, is really impressive. And we just had this commitment that the full team were prepared to go out of their comfort zone, I think, is a way to describe it, to deliver something that's really unique. And that's exciting. When everyone has that same commitment and that same drive, you really will end up somewhere that's quite spectacular. There's three of us in Sydney. It kind of expands and contracts. And we had issues like most practices during COVID of how to deal with working remotely and then restaffing after COVID as well, getting people, you know, comfortable coming into an office and those changing their lifestyle. And so we've reached out to some contractors to join the team over in Europe, in Poland and Ukraine, because my wife, who's also in the practice, is Polish and I'm half Ukrainian. That's my mother's side. And we saw it as an opportunity to just look further afield, change the model of practice a little bit. And we now have this pretty fun and dynamic online existence, all of us. And we will be making trips there semi-regularly to see family and also to connect with the team on the top side, we call them. Got the down under side and the top side. Yeah, and it's really quite good. It just adds that richness of yeah. some sort of cultural references and experiences to the design conversation. So it's not just me with my upbringing here in Sydney. You know, it's much more diverse, all the influences.
And what made you decide on, I guess, apart from the connection, was it how much was economics a driver of that decision and how much was it just finding the right people in Australia? Because I mean, obviously that's become a hot topic at the moment for finding staff, as we had a brief chat about before. But so what drove that decision?
I mean, there is this sense that there's an attractive idea that there's a difference in economies in various countries, and there's that advantage with expected salaries, but in reality, there is still some inefficiencies, obviously, working remotely, and we all experience that just within the same city, let alone, and that I think does add a bit more admin from our side. So at the end of the day, I think it's probably same for same, but it still covers itself, if that makes sense, as a working model. And some of the other sort of drivers were a little more sort of personal. Because of my Ukrainian connection, I felt like I would like to be doing something meaningful during the conflict over there, during this war that's ensuing. And it felt good to give an architect, someone else who has a passion for creating buildings, to still practice their craft when ultimately their whole existence is in question right now. So it's quite rewarding to be giving someone, again, that sense of purpose.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And with any luck, I mean, the war is unsustainable. So with any luck, they're going to, you know, Ukrainian architects are going to be busy in the Ukraine. We hope rebuilding, and you know, but yeah, it's yeah. I had a similar experience where I hired a Ukrainian, like just through Upwork, I hired a Ukrainian graphic designer, and I didn't even clock the fact that he was Ukrainian at the time. He seemed really, really good, but then he disappeared for a while, and then I was like, I wonder, he's been reliable, I wonder what happened. And I realized, oh my god, he's in Kiev, he's probably hiding. And
yeah
I was like, oh, you know, and then you kind of go, well, we're having lots of floods and rain events here and disruptions, and like, actually we're doing all right, you know, we're okay here, we're not getting bombed by a lunatic. But you know, that put things in context.
And I find also that the tertiary education over in Europe and there in Eastern Europe it's very high quality, and the architects are well trained in not just design, but they're well trained in the technical aspects as well, such as, you know, engineering and construction, and also really up on all the software. So I found that quite fruitful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On that note, before we jump into the meat of the episode, we always like to start off with sharing one person who has inspired us this past week. And I know Daniel, coming off that discussion to do with people in Ukraine, I know that you have an interesting story to share with us.
That's right. Yeah. So I just, this bit of a shout out to Maxim, who is working with us right now. And the rest of the team are consistently astounded at how upbeat and impassioned he is with his architectural projects, which he's doing for us. It seems to be that regardless of being in the center of this mass destruction of, there's the killing of people, which is, you know, meant to be there to demoralize a nation, but also destruction of buildings, also to demoralize, you know, and he is the flip side to that, this beautiful counterbalance of still creating projects for us in quite a contradictory way, that here we are with somewhat, you know, wealthy clients and beautiful settings here in Sydney, and there's no sort of spite or ill will that he is here helping us create more comfortable lives for people in a very comfortable situation. I think that's quite inspiring. And even last night I had a meeting with him, just the time difference is normally about, you know, 6 p.m. or something. And again, the air raids went off.
Yeah.
And he sort of said, you know, well, let's continue this. But he just grabbed his phone, went into the corridor, because that's, you're two walls away from a facade where a missile strike is likely to, you know, really injure you or kill you. And we just continue the meeting there. And that is just the reality. Mm. So I just think it's a wonderful little caricature of an architect who in the in really the depth of the antithesis of creating buildings, here he is still in passion. So I think it's quite inspiring.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
My inspiration this week is on not from a very different background, but it's a lady called Sabine Hossenfelder, who's a German theoretical physicist, but I'm a closet science nerd, which my close friend know about, and now everyone listening knows about. But the thing I love about her is she just calls bullshit on a lot of science that is bullshit, like you know, nuclear fusion, which is wherever we are, it's always 20 years away, and it's you know, but she's actually reading a book she's written called Lost in Maths, where she's really calling out theoretical physicists for wasting everyone's time, wasting a lot of money pursuing some beautiful ideas that have very little chance of being ever tested. So that's kind of it is inspiring, because there is a lot of and it's common in every industry and every demographic. People do things the way they do things because that's how they're done. And she's kind of going, hang on a minute, you've had this multi-billion dollar Large Hadron Collider that's really proved the inevitable sort of discovery of or proof of the Higgs, which we kind of knew was there, but it's disproven everything else you've come up with, and you keep changing your mind, and and there's an industry around it that she's really calling out. I've probably not done justice to as a summary being a non-physicist, but I really enjoy just her very upfront and very full frontal attack on science that doesn't make sense when you think about it.
Well, that's really disappointing, because I was hoping that with our nuclear fusion reactors that we're all going to carry around in our back pockets, we're going to have all of our energy problems solved in the next couple of years.
If something solves our problem, it's probably not going to be nuclear fusion anytime soon. That's the reality. It doesn't stack up. They claim, and that's the thing that she cuts straight through that. And I've been watching her YouTube channel. It's fantastic. But she cuts through all the data and says, they tell you that it's actually producing, it's the net energy, but that's that's a very selective way of saying it. There's a lot of energy that goes into it before you get that return on energy. There's nowhere near being anything. But anyway, Jeannie, who inspired you this week?
So for me this week, I've just been thinking and reflecting a lot on this trip that I had away with uni last weekend to Jervis Bay. It leads on to the things that we were talking about earlier, cultural appreciation, I guess. So for me, it was a great opportunity to meet some Aboriginal elders and have them share their culture and their perspective on Australia and their outlook in life and their approach to life in general, and just how different it is from my own, the modern Western culture we live in. So I thought that was a real mind bender, just having those conversations and having a really deep think about a lot of things. And also just on a human level, on a personal level, I really admired their sense of family and community and their respect for their roots. I picked that out as something that is that I admire, because maybe I feel like in a way that's something that I feel a bit disconnected from. So I don't know. This is a more personal example, but I think it was just a real thinker, that experience for me.
Yeah. That's good. Well, that's the most diverse sort of group. from a Ukrainian architect to a German.
Yeah.
To a German physicist to
a wonderful three will meet one day. Yeah. it's interesting that you mentioned the Indigenous community there, because just recently the Board of Architects has created some mandatory experience for registered architects in New South Wales, where we are required now to do understanding country as part of our
research. Yeah. So you can see it trickling into the university system, especially with the course leaders, faculty leaders. They're starting to make more of an effort to invite Aboriginal elders in to share their understanding of their culture. And that's actually what sparked my interest in the first place to do this. Just listening to a talk from a lady who on face value is quite scary. She's very passionate. She's very, you can hear the hurt or some kind of, yeah, like she was quite strong the way she presented her views. But again, there's a reason for that. And I think for me, it was just interesting to dig deeper and to understand more. So yeah. So thanks everyone for sharing. We're now ready to jump into our questions for Daniel and Matt. So starting with the basics, what is the definition of a contract?
Daniel, do you want to take us away?
Okay,
since I'm talking, I may as well keep going and just shut me up at any moment. But I guess a contract is something that is an agreement. And I think what we want to do is just preempt this discussion to say we're not lawyers and we're not providing legal advice about contracts. There is a lot of information on the Fair Trading website, particularly, which we can post a link to. So we're just going to be, it's just going to be a builder and an architect in lay terms, trying to outline like our perspective. But yeah, but just please get your own advice from a lawyer or from a trusted source. But essentially, a contract is an agreement to execute or deliver a product or service in exchange for typically money. Can be another product or service in exchange, but it's just when you break it down, it's an agreement. The thing about a contract that I remember from studying, I had this contract lecture that was started at 6 and finished at 8 on a Thursday night, and of course happy hour was from 6:30 to 7:30. Which was always awkward because you had to. There was a 10-minute break in between the first hour and the second hour where you could run down and have a quick beer and run back. But what I do remember is that a contract can be verbal, and it just needs to be something that has the intent of both parties to enter into. But the other thing is that it doesn't have to. The other thing that stands out, which I didn't know until I learned it, is that the value doesn't need to be proportional to the service. So you can in theory, as long as you've agreed to it, you can buy a car for a dollar or get it or purchase a house for a dollar if that's what you've agreed. That's what you're stuck with. And I think in bringing it back to construction and architecture, it's an accepted standard that a contract is formally signed and written. And in fact, you will not comply with the law if you do not, as a builder, sign a contract that's for residential work, particularly, as I understand, that's the contracts that I'm familiar with anyway. So there are some limits. So $5,000, under $5,000, it's accepted that you may not need a contract. And then there's a minor contract between $5,000 and $20,000, and over $20,000, it's necessary to have a written contract in place to do do building work. Daniel, have you got anything?
Yeah, it's interesting. Between your trips down to have beers and those lectures, I also recall something similar where it's an intent to do something as well, because I've been quite nervous sometimes when I so. This is not a building contract, it's a client architect agreement, which is what the term we use, that, you know, you send this off and at the beginning of a project, everyone is very excited and you sometimes just skip over the signing of it because you just, what's the point? We're all going to create something incredible here. And I've sought advice on that. And as long as someone has seen an agreement or a contract and is aware of it and you know they've received it, the intent is very clear. So I think that is always a good sort of reassurance that if something is not signed, it still is binding. And the other one was they often, the term is you often just, the best sort of contract sits in the bottom drawer and you never refer to it. But I sort of disagree with that because I think a contract is not necessarily there to sort of, it's not a mechanism to throw the book at someone when they've stepped out of line. I think it also should be quite productive in guiding the next steps for parties. Mm-hmm. If something does come up or you're at a milestone, it's then very clear what should be happening and you've got that. Someone who writes a good contract is aware of the potential events coming up, and they've already sort of pre-written the script to tell you what you should be doing as each party. So I think it should be a fundamental part of how you conduct your practice or your business. In fact, in my client architect agreements, each of the sections of the services that we provide, we check in with that at the end of a stage to say, have we actually delivered what we should have delivered? Not because we feel compelled to do it, but it's actually a really good check-in on things that should be reviewed or finalized before moving forwards. And I think the same for a building contract as well.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify what you were saying earlier, did you say that even if nothing is signed on the dotted line, as long as through email or through physical copy it's been delivered, or like that would be considered a binding agreement?
This is not legal advice. Contract? This is no. I just know that in the circumstance of a client architect agreement, I have been told in one instance that as long as it's been received and they're aware of it, if there's an awareness that they are moving forward with this agreement, sort of covered, yeah. But in the construction, I believe that you do need a signed agreement, and also as a registered architect, you do need a signed client architect agreement. So that's kind of like another requirement from the Board of Architects that it must be signed. So you'd be crazy not to get it signed.
So the thing that I've learned through experience is that whatever the written document is will just trump anything else that's said or done. And in fact, once you've signed a contract, any discussion you've had before is meaningless under the law, and the contract becomes the primary document that you refer to. And I think the thing to be that maybe I've learned that I didn't know from the outset is that what's literally written in not only in the contract but what's written is the key thing that's taken if it ever goes to a court of law. What's written trumps anything else.
That's right. What's going to look better when you're standing there in front of a courtroom and you're saying, well, this conversation that everyone's forgotten is hardly going to stand up, is it?
Exactly. And what's written, and not only that, but what's the thing that I've understood because just to be upfront, I was involved in a legal dispute and I only once, and I did go to court, and I remember the judge saying over and over again, the words speak for themselves. You cannot imply that someone meant something
right
when they said something. It's the interpretation of the words. And I can assure you that there is nothing like having your own words read out to you that brings it home. That makes all of the advice that you've been given make sense.
Yep.
Because unless when you hear your own email read out, and it, that's when you understand why everyone takes notes, and why everyone's, and particularly some architects are very meticulous in taking notes. But that's the key. What the contract, whatever was the discussion prior to contract, is completely irrelevant. The written word in the contract takes precedence. So I guess from a client's perspective, if your builders promise this and promise that and promise to give you the best deal in town, and it's meaningless if you haven't put it in the contract. So that I think that might be where something's go wrong, where there's promises made and there's a perception from the client that they're getting something. So my advice is, what you're getting is exactly what's in the contract. Presume that what you're getting is exactly what's in the contract, because no other conversation or email or anything that preempted that signing of the contract has any bearing on it, from my experience.
That's a good point as well, defining what is the contract, because you have, a pre-written, typically by a legal outfit, a document that sort of stipulates clause by clause what should happen. But then you also have your contract documents, which can include drawings by the architect, or by a window supplier or something. Then you also have a specification which can outline quality and Australian standard compliance and other standard compliance. And these could or should form part of that contract documentation set. And I recall early on when I was being probably too pedantic with contract signing, where we took all these documents and physically punched holes through them with a nail and a hammer, so that it was very clear that this was the set that was there at that meeting and that cannot be disputed in the future. So that I think that's absolutely key, because it's very common you sit down at a meeting at the beginning of a project, and you're throwing around some ideas such as, oh, my mate's got some, a truckload of bricks, why don't we just use those, and I can save you some money here, et cetera. And everyone's like, yes, this is fantastic. What a collaborative kind of A-team we are here. But if that's not recorded, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you are obliged, the other thing is in terms of the structure, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, pull me back, Jeannie, if you need to, but the structure of the contract, the type of contract, it is important to understand for your client.
Yeah.
And it's in your interest as a contractor or an architect that your client does understand the contract and their obligation, and particularly if they bear, as with invoice cost contract or cost, not commonly known as a cost plus contract, they bear price escalation risk in that contract.
Yeah, so this actually leads us on to our next question, which is, I think, where you can elaborate a bit more. What are the different contract types and their application usage, now that we've defined what a contract is?
I've just made a quick list of the main ones that I'm particularly aware of. For architects, we often prefer to use what's called an ABIC contract, Australian Industry Building Contract. And these were co-authored with the Master Builders Association and the Australian Institute of Architects. So it is presumably a well-balanced, unbiased contract for the owner and the contractor, i.e. the builder. But it does always involve an architect as the administrator for that contract. So there they are, again, meant to be impartial. and they, which is difficult since they're being engaged by the owner or their client to be part of that contract, they still need to act impartially, pardon me, to ensure that what is in the contract documentation is delivered by the contractor and that the monies that are owed are paid on time and at appropriate amounts. And then the other ones are MBA, Master Builders Association, and that was authored obviously by them. And it does include as addendums, I think, a to be administered by an architect. But I find these are actually quite good. They're much simpler. They do allow for contracting between just an owner of a building and a contractor or a builder. And I think, again, it is quite fair, but it, you have to always be a little bit suspicious that the author of a contract is going to invariably have some bias to the organization or the people they represent. So the ABIC contract does have a bit of a bias to the architect being involved, MBA towards builders. Then you have HIA contracts, and then Standards Australia have one as well. AS 4000, which is more common with government work and commercial work. And generally, all of these come under what I would consider to be either a lump sum contract, rather than calling it a fixed price, because no contract ever is really fixed. There are mechanisms there that do allow it to change. A cost plus, or maybe a hybrid of the both. And then maybe a design and construct, which I have kind of less experience with.
Yeah, I think we focus on the main two types, and they are, I mean, there are contracts available from in New South Wales from Fair Trading as well that are standardised, and that one might be quite useful, like for, I guess, some of our listeners if their builder hasn't got a contract ready or is, you know, a bit clueless or inefficient with their paperwork. Well, that's not a bad option, particularly for smaller projects, that they're readily available to download for free from Fair Trading. And it's, hopefully, yeah, again, we can share a link, but they're readily fine if I can find them.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone can find them. There is, I guess, the thing that I learned through a lot of experience is that the architect's role, I found in administering the contract, wasn't what I thought it was when I started in the industry. And when push comes to shove, the architect is still when the dust settles and all is said and done, the architect remains the agent of the owner and the contract, and they are mentioned in the contract, but they are not, strictly speaking, a party to the contract. Their fundamental role when all said and done is as an agent of the owner. They're obliged to administer it, but in the course of a dispute, they are seen as the an agent of the owner first and foremost. And the other thing that is really interesting that I've found out is that an architect typically assesses building costs, but technically they're not qualified to assess building costs. So that's one of the, you know, and I being in construction for a very long time, I've always been quite conservative in adjusting costs of work, and I don't know if you've had this experience, Daniel, but I have at times submitted a variation where I've detailed the quantity of the work, the rate that's charged, and the architects come back to me and just said it's too expensive. And I'm like, well, which bit? Is it the rate or is it the quant? Which one have I got wrong?
Just ask the architect to go and build it themselves then at a cheaper price, you know?
No, well, it wasn't. I'm very, you know, I very much like value the keep maintaining a good relationship. So I wouldn't suggest that particularly.
But I do agree that the architect really doesn't have a mechanism or a right to say this is what the building cost would be, because they are not putting in an offer to do any building themselves, right? So I think if they are going to challenge it, they need to get a third party to challenge it. You just get you go and get another quote from another contractor, or you ask a quantity surveyor to jump in there and give you an estimate if you think it does look suspiciously out of whack. But with variations, yeah, it's very, I don't think the architect really has a role there to tell the builder how much it's going to cost them to do something. Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, I think they do have a role to say, can you explain how you've come up with it? Because that solves a lot of problems. If you kind of go, well, here's what we've measured it to be, here's how many hours we've factored in, and here's the rate that we're charging. It might be the project rate, it might be a rate that didn't make it into the project, but you know, so you can do a little bit of simple due diligence, but yeah, I guess that like building costs generally, and like anything, those items, I call it the Woolies, you know, the Woolies sort of small shop where you drop in to buy a bottle of milk or something, and then you pick up a few other things, and then you kind of go, hang on a minute, how the fuck can this be $50? You know, Woolies never makes a mistake. So you kind of go, how did that happen?
Yeah.
I think we might be getting off topic, but
a little bit.
I'll let Jeannie rein us back in.
Just out of all the contract types we've listed above, there's quite a few. So Matt, you were saying that we could probably summarize them into two main categories. Can we just outline those two categories and talk about how, like, what options we have in the current market and kind of what's at play currently?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, lump sum, otherwise known as fixed price, on the one hand, open book, otherwise known as cost plus or invoice cost plus margin. Too broad, that they're, you know, I don't know what percentage. If I had to guess, I'd say probably 95% of building contracts are one of those two. And I think I have to issue a correction from what I might have said in a previous podcast, because I've looked into it a bit further, and I understood that banks weren't engaging with cost plus contracts, and that they have in the past, and I've sort of learned that banks have never liked cost plus contracts. They've always preferred lump sum contracts. But because costs have risen and lending rules have tightened up, more people are forced into a construction loan, whereas maybe 5 or 10 years ago, a lot of people funded construction from their overdraft or from a different type of lending or mechanism or a redraw facility or something else. Whereas I guess today more of our clients are pushed into a construction loan. Mm-hmm. So and so I had a chat with my broker the other day to say, has this what's changing? And actually it's changing in a way that I misunderstood. It's actually banks are moving towards cost plus, and CommBank is, I understand, the first bank to approve cost plus contracts. And I mean, the reason I jumped into funding is because that drives, particularly at the moment, that drives the contract form, because we've traditionally done a lot of our work on an open book basis, and whereas we're kind of pushed into fixing the price, and of course we carry the price contingency, which at the moment, what is that contingency is the question that even the Reserve Bank doesn't know the answer to. So essentially it's not how I thought it was, but there are factors that have pushed more and more of our clients into a traditional construction loan.
So Daniel, what's your experience in this area? I understand that you think that cost plus and also hybrid contracts, if you could just elaborate on that as well. These will become increasingly common.
Yeah, I do think so, because in fact I co-chaired a conversation on Wednesday morning with something called the Small Practice Forum at the AIA.
Which is the Australian
Institute of Architects.
Yep.
It's a voluntary membership, and they're there to advocate for architects and what they do. And there's a very good semi-regular forum where we get together and we discuss topics, you know, hot topics at the moment. And it's meant to be a safe space to sort of, you know, have an open conversation about it. And we invited along a couple of builders to have a conversation, particularly about cost plus, because with the unknowns around what a subcontractor might charge, or primarily a supplier of these materials is going to have to charge, a lot of builders have been caught out. And as we know, some have gone into liquidation because they're locked in to this contract that had no mechanism there for price increases. And so it's just not feasible to keep using this contract type in the future with so many unknowns. In fact, even so things like COVID, if suddenly all your workforce were off sick in mandatory isolation, how could you be expected to still deliver that project on time? You can't. And then the question comes up, well, who's paying for the cost of having scaffolding on site or something for that period of time? And if it's not in the contract, there's no way of really just sort of allocating those costs to either the builder or to the owner. The same happened with the bushfires, where, again, people were, you know, they were struggling to work on building sites because of the smoke. And, again, who's going to cover those costs? There are mechanisms there for rain, which I think now needs to be reassessed as well. Like, you have what you call your wet weather days, and that's a typical kind of proportion, you know, one day a fortnight or something where you can expect you can't do any work, and that's already written into the contract. But we're finding it's moving, all of these new kind of phenomena are coming in so quickly, the contracts are all falling behind and just don't cover those scenarios. So builders have said, it's got to stop. We can't put our livelihoods on the line anymore, and we will just charge what it costs us plus the preliminaries and our overheads. And in reality, that is kind of the fairest way to do it, because they're no longer going to be taking their bite of the cherry with big profits from a project. So they've lost that opportunity, but it also means they're not going to risk losing their business by not predicting some sort of horrible scenario just around the corner. So, Matt, the conversation there about the banks is a big issue. And some of the builders have said you shouldn't feel afraid by whether a bank is going to approve the loan or not, because you can always go to another bank. You know, you can shop around to find someone that's going to support your contract type. And you can also play, you can dial up and dial down these things called provisional sums and prime cost items. And I think Matt probably can talk better to that, being in the building trade, where you don't necessarily lock yourself in to what it's going to cost you as the builder to spend time and the labor. And then with the prime cost items, if they're not selected, again, you're not locking yourself into that. So I think that's become a really good way to have this wriggle room for a builder where you lock in your preliminaries, you lock in your overheads, and then the rest of it is a bit of a wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that is a good point. There are mechanisms within a contract, but I think it's the appetite of your client. I mean, there are things that are reasonable to provisionalize, as you said, provisional sums or prime cost items. Sometimes the two are confused, and we won't even go into the technicality between the difference between the both of them. That's something for another episode, yeah. Probably for a different podcast, not ours. But essentially, it's very similar, and I guess they're for unknown costs that are coming up that are isolated from the contract. But I think the greatest risk in price, I think price of materials has been in the headlines, but it's the price of labor and the price of it's the subcontract labor, particularly. You know, it's a matter of it's not even a matter of getting a good price on bricklaying. It's a matter of finding a bricklayer who is available, you know, like, so those factors drive up price, and lack of immigration is hurting, and we chatted before about Uber and other employers taking traditional labor away, and you can't blame people for working on their own calendar to their own time frame and a lot of time getting paid more to drive an Uber than they would get on site. So that they're things that have definitely affected it. But I have to admit, I forgot what the question was. <That's rambled. laughs> You'll have to.
So moving on, Daniel, what are some of your suggestions with all these different market economic conditions happening in front of us? What are some of your suggestions in terms of approaching a new working relationship between all shareholders? So that's including the clients, the builders, the architects. What do we need to consider?
I think that it's going to have to be far more sort of collaborative than it has in the past and much more open book. So I think all three parties are going to just have to be totally transparent. Clients are going to have to be realistic from the outset, or owners should be realistic from the outset that this is their budget. I mean, there are sometimes a few funny games that go on where budgets are underquoted to keep, architects' fees down, consultants' fees down, even to manage builders' costings as well. This is only the money I have. Yet there's something else there that they're prepared to spend if they had to. It's not always that simple. I mean, I've been on projects where a client has said, I've got this money in the bank, but then by the end of a design discussion and process, as I say, we love to take our clients on a journey, they discover something that they hadn't imagined and they think this is incredible and we see the value in it and it makes sense. We will take out another loan to fund this project. So it's very hard to lock everything in before you even know what the project might be. And I think because of that, everyone needs to be prepared to cover their costs, cover their time, a bit of profit, but then have the flexibility to sort of dial things up and down depending on where the project starts to head, and to be really nimble and agile with that as well. Because the reality is, I mean, you're about to start carpentry on a project and suddenly timber prices have gone, off the scale. What do you do? Do you start looking at maybe CLT or a steel framing? And rather than penalizing people in that relationship for making changes, I think you're just going to have to collaboratively find a better solution, and you've all got some skin in the game, and it just makes sense to take a different avenue to deliver a better project end of the day. So I think it's about being, yeah, more open book and transparency to deliver something together, yeah, as opposed to seeking a hungry builder who's going to charge the lowest, you know, tender price.
It sounds like it's a change of perspective as well. Like in the past, where when there are changes made, I think that's called a variable. So like that's, I guess that's what you're saying. It would be something to be penalized. There would be a more of a cost to it. But then now, because everywhere, everything is changing, I guess it's also the culture and the thinking around those things. It's not something to be penalized. It's something just to be smoothed out by everyone.
That's right. Yeah. So
understanding.
Yeah. I mean, some people call them variations. And so with a variation, you find that a builder feels very comfortable sometimes to throw a big margin on top of that. So in fact, often you have a preliminary margin that's a lower figure than a variation margin. In fact, Matt, maybe you could talk to that a little bit. Why traditionally is the variation margin higher?
I don't know the answer, but I feel that it is, there is more prelim cost in a variation because you do have to price it. You do have to administer that as an extra item in the contract. So that's possibly one reason.
And you change your gear suddenly as well. Like you've got your whole sort of program mapped out that you're using a timber structure and suddenly it's steel. That has a lot of knock-on effects.
Yeah. So the risk to that impacting on other things is greater, I guess, than something that you've known from the outset.
Yeah.
And you plan for. And sometimes you can't predict everything that's going to, you can't sit there and think through every contingency and every possible item that might be impacted by this change. Sometimes that those repercussions come out later in the wash. So I think, but it is whatever's agreed in the end and it's written into a contract. But yeah, I think it should be more because it's a different risk profile for that work and a different amount of admin. Whereas for at the head contract and the main contract, you know, there's an economy in putting a lot of work together into it. And the admin of that is spread over a longer, a larger figure. So, I think that the thing I was going to just come back to in and I was going to get your opinion, Daniel, in with cost plus contracts, I have a hypothesis that the biggest problem with them is an inadequate budget before you've even started. I think that's where cost plus fails as a mechanism, and that's where it can fail, and it often does fail because In my experience in the past, a cost plus tender feels a lot like any other tender, and the client does tend to favor the lowest price, and you kind of go, so the tendency is if you can promise a lesser price, you might be able to win it from a builder's perspective. So I think it's the fact how you approach it and how you structure it. If you go into a cost plus contract, I think you need independent pricing.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting actually, because I think that's a big risk as well, that you're relying on the expertise of the builder to estimate what things might cost. And if they get that wrong, then you're all in serious trouble because you've end up somewhere a half-built building. In fact, I recently heard a story where a major alts and ads, so the part of the home has been demolished and the costs come in from the contractors, and it's actually double than what the builder originally estimated, and that has suddenly taken a huge chunk out of the available budget for the project. And then what does the owner do then?
Yeah.
Do they abandon the project? Do they suddenly reduce the scale of the new works? I mean, it's a serious issue. And who is held liable for that? Kind of no one. And I think that's why owners really balk at it. And in fact, the AIA, Institute of Architects, is always, they don't even offer a cost plus contract for us to administer because it's such a minefield.
Yeah.
If you were to go down that way. So it's a problem. So the contract that we need moving forward doesn't really exist, I don't think, at the moment.
Yeah, right. I've seen the cost plus contract work really well. I think the biggest failure is, and again, the builder has this great, if I can call it a moral hazard, because they want the project. So they, and they're not, it's not that they're trying to trick anyone, because everyone wants it to cost less than it actually does.
Go on, that's human nature, right? We're all very optimistic.
And we're all optimistic. And the most optimistic builder tends to get the work, or they feel that there's a pressure to deliver it for a lower cost. So they're actually, I wonder, you know, I've often wondered, and I think I can sort of, I've got enough experience to kind of understand it a little bit, although I don't have any empirical data, but I think the biggest failure is the baseline was always wrong. So it was always destined to fail. But I guess the problem with, and I agree that there might be something better, because the reverse problem occurs with a lump sum contract. If the builder's under allowed, most builders tend to shop around and work out creative solutions, and some will cut corners to get it. So if their budgets are blowing out, they're going to have to do something, otherwise they're going to send themselves broke.
Absolutely. So if something's got over price somewhere, they're going to have to save some money somewhere else. So at the end of the day, the occupant of that building is really going to end up with that original estimate, aren't they?
And it's, in a funny way, things have a tendency to just equalize themselves out. So you end up, if your budget's too low, whether you've got a lump sum contract or you've got a fixed price contract, Daniel, if you were to write a contract, like, what is that ideal contract? How's it structured? What's in it? What's not in it? And what's the standard contract in your
world? Well, I'd certainly make sure that there's a clause there that requires hot coffee and muffins at the site meetings, obviously. And then but also I think that we need to anticipate that building anything is the first time that team have done that on that site, under those planning kind of controls and conditions, with those materials, with the seasons of that year. And you cannot predict what will take place. And you have things called latent conditions also. So there might be rock while you're excavating. There might be asbestos in the fill when you're excavating. And then all the other kind of unknowns, which are becoming quite known, as we discussed earlier, they really do change the way that you move forward. So it's unrealistic to document something, put a price on it, and deliver it. And I think that the better approach is that there is a flexibility and an agility of all three parties, primarily, to be revisiting, reconsidering, and adjusting the design, the documentation, and the construction to best suit the constraints and opportunities as they present themselves. So if something has come in suddenly at a higher price and it is important in the project, then yes, you still move forwards with that. But then with your design team and construction team, you sit down and look at something else that could be reworked to bring those costs down to balance up the whole project. So I think that would be, for me, an ideal sort of team approach to construction.
Mm-hmm. So that leads pretty well into, I guess, a summary of the different things that we've been talking about today and for the best outcomes. But just to summarize for our listeners, in short sentences, do you think you can come up with the three key things to consider when it comes to choosing the right contract for their project? Just three short, simple things for the listeners to keep in mind to take away from this episode.
So let me start. Let me jump in.
Yep.
And nothing's going to be short. So, but I think the main thing to consider, like in the main message that I would have to broadly to listeners, whether they're a builder or an architect, it's, you know, whatever's written takes precedence. Whatever's in the contract, whatever's promised before the contract, there's lots of lovely conversations about dreams, and it's what's written that takes precedence. If you ever, and the purpose of a contract is really to, if, you know, like I mean, I'm probably from the school of thought that the contract sits in the bottom drawer and you pull it out to, if you need to administer something, like remember what the percentage fee is on or a scheduled value is, or a time, whatever, in the reference. And you tend to settle in on a lot of contracts. It is more like an insurance policy in practice, because you develop a working relationship and things tend to follow the path of least resistance. So if everything's working, the job's being delivered, the client's paying their bills and the architect's doing their job, like the contract is irrelevant. And then you pull it out at the end to kind of remember what the retention fee or the retention value should be, or something like that, or what the process is in completion of the, but it is an insurance. It definitely is an insurance policy. And if you get in, and like any insurance, it's when you get into trouble that it proves its worth. And the contract's no different. But it is what's written that absolutely takes precedence. So whatever you've been promised is to some extent irrelevant if it's not in the contract. So that's one. That's a very long. But I think we didn't really dig a lot into what's in or out. I mean, there's so much to talk about, but I think that the gist of it is that I think most, you know, my consistent view is that contracts fail at inception when the budget is inadequate. And that's the greatest point of failure. They also fail if they're mismanaged, and if work's mismanaged. And so you do need to, sometimes the architect knows what they're doing, the builder knows what they're doing, everyone's on side, getting along, things tick along, everyone's just gets into a pattern. But sometimes that doesn't happen, and back to Daniel's point, the contract is a very good operating guide or procedure for what needs to happen. You do get into informal arrangements that work really, really well, and you know, in my experience, 90% of the time or more, they work really well from the first time you're on site to when you finish rectifying defects. That everything's ticked along and been fine. But if it's not, you know, I think if it's not working or there's a question, yeah, I think I agree. Look at the processes outlined in the contract. They're there for a reason. And I'll let Daniel, that was 2 points, yeah. But
that's okay. Those are the key ones. Yeah.
No, it's good. I appreciate the long, short answer. It gave me time to, of 3 points here. Before the 3 points, I just wanted to mention that there's this term called ECI that's bouncing around a lot. It's early contractor involvement, and it's recognized as a recipe for quite a successful collaboration with a builder. And I suppose that is my first point, is that it is important that the relationship is a good mix, that the key players are a good fit, because you're going to be working very closely together for quite a long time. So the right builder with the right project, ideally with the right architect as well. And then there's kind of a good sort of synergy there to move forward. Mm-hmm. And that means not until you know who the three key players are should you really be selecting the contract anyway, because the contract needs to suit them and their sort of peculiarities as well. Their strengths, their weaknesses, and their risks should then be identified and written into that contract. Second one is that at the beginning of a project, everybody is supremely excited and pumped for this incredible journey that they're about to embark on. But invariably, about three quarters of the way through every single project I've been involved in, things can get quite tense. And that is because you're under some real pressures to deliver on time with the monies, and you've absorbed all of those unknowns, and everybody's stretched to their limits, including the owners and the architect and the builder.
Yeah.
So be prepared for the challenges and a bumpy road ahead on the project. And that is where you can then lean on the contract, just remind everyone what they have promised to deliver, and to keep everyone in a sort of professional behavior when things sometimes feel like it's a pressure cooker. And the third point is, it's not all about the difficulties. It should also be about the delight and the celebration in how all three parties under a contract can deliver something really quite inspiring and spectacular. And I think that needs to almost, it should be part of the contract that you, at the end of the build, everyone needs to get together and have celebratory drinks and congratulate each other. Because I think if you're not enjoying this, you probably shouldn't be investing so much of your kind of vocation and life's work into producing, you know, beautiful spaces. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to add like one little, I feel like I'm going to take it down.
Your third one.
you've raised this up, but I did have something to add to your first point, Daniel. And I apologize for
that's okay.
Derailing the beautiful climatic sort of almost evangelical ending, but the thing that is really important with contracts is, if you've got the wrong builder and or the wrong design or the wrong team or the wrong combination, no contract is going to save you.
Like, I agree.
It is so, you know, and I think my experience is that clients come into a build thinking that, hey, everything's all right because I've got a set of documents and a contract. So what? I'm solid here, like, right? What could go wrong? If you've got the wrong building company that are not qualified or inexperienced in delivering that type of project, or just not interested, or whatever, if you've got the wrong team, or you've got an architect that goes missing in whatever, like if you've got the wrong people, no contract is going to help.
Yeah,
it's might help marginally, but it's that's the most important thing is to, and I agree. So I agree with you, Daniel, the right team.
Yep. I agree. The human relationships are going to trump whatever is on paper anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's the fundamental to get right. And the contracts there, to help the process and as an insurance policy, if things don't go right.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that note, thank you so much, Matt. Thank you so much, Daniel, for your lively discussions during this episode. I think we've covered a lot of ground and there's a lot for our listeners to think about when it comes to the topic of contracts. So if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners like you find our podcast. And for more information, please check out the show notes and connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
See you later. Bye.
This has been great.
Thank you for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners like you find our podcast. For more information, please check out the show notes and connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you.